find such a love at our age? Whoever thought we could dance on a thrill?
Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmers.
Well, hello, Judy. Hello, viewers and listeners. Judy, tell folks the title of our episode today.
Polyamory: Lessons for Monogamy and Burning Man, an interview with Kathy Slaughter.
And Kathy Slaughter was just fascinating.
Yes.
We just finished our interview with them. And I'll just leave it to folks to check that out. We mentioned at the end of the interview, actually, we'd been talking about doing an episode on polyamory for quite a while. I hadn't managed to arrange someone.
Mm-hmm.
And along comes Kathy and...
Perfect person to discuss it with.
Because they're in a polyamorous relationship
mm-hmm.
themselves and a therapist, right?
And a therapist,
yes. And work with folks at various stages along the way. And
mm-hmm.
and they're very, you know, very articulate about it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously, well, one of the things that Kathy had done was a TED Talk, which has like over 400,000 views at this point. And so obviously they've had some experience talking about it, and it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice person, too.
Yeah.
So we invite you to stay tuned for that. First, I want to put in a plug for our books. And as I've started doing, I want to give you a reason to buy these things. Not merely the fact that I wrote a couple of these books, and I think they're good because I wrote them. But I want to give you some reasons for actually buying them. So if you could, yes, hold up our props here. Go ahead.
It's not about communication. Why everything you know about couples therapy is wrong.
Yeah, that's my more recent book. That's the one. How can I characterize this? Why should you buy that book? You should buy that book if you're, first of all, if you're a therapist yourself, you should definitely buy that book. It will challenge your ideas. I hope it will be provocative. It'll make you want to shoot me an email telling me how wrong I am. And I will love to get that email because you're probably right about how wrong I am. I love that. So if you're a therapist, absolutely. If you're not a therapist, which is most of you watching this, you should get that book because it'll help you know how to make use of therapy. It'll bust some myths about therapy,
mm-hmm.
and it'll actually help you find maybe a therapist that's right for you. So all of those reasons are good reasons to get that book. Then there's, as you always like to call it,
the book that started it all, Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
Yeah, and the reason to get that book, it's funny, I'm just sort of abstracted a bunch of feedback I've gotten about
mm-hmm.
that. The reason to get that book is it'll help you feel better. It actually will help you feel better. It's funny to say that. It's got this sort of, you know, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of it's a left brain kind of title,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But
well,
it's,
you know, you've gotten comments from people who said, you know, one woman, I think, said her relationship wasn't even in trouble, but reading this just kind of got her going.
Yeah, and exactly. So even if you're not feeling bad, it'll help you feel better.
Yeah.
If you are feeling bad, it'll help you feel better. And while we're on the subject of books that'll help you feel better, I want to tell you about a book that I haven't even written yet. We'll get to our sponsor in a second. No, a book that I'm in the middle of. I'm maybe about 2/3 of the way through right now.
Yeah.
And the working title of that book is Betrayal, Forgiveness, and Faith. And boy, is that a book designed to help you feel better, especially if you've been betrayed. And, you know, betrayal is a big issue. That's most of the folks I'm working with.
Everybody has been betrayed in some way.
If you've lived long enough, you've probably been betrayed one way or another. And betrayal,
yeah.
there's small betrayals and there's big betrayals. And I'm talking about a lot of the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that book is, watch for that. Of course, we will make a big hoopla about it when it actually exists and is published, which is still a few months down the line.
Yeah.
Now, let us put in, speaking of books that help you feel good, and I'll say better, but I'm just going to say help you feel good, we have...
The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
By Laria Zilber, and she's really good at making you feel good. I know that from personal experience, what can I say? Judy, why don't you tell us who Laria is?
Laria is me.
Exactly,
yes,
Laria is your
Laria.
Pseudonym. And you have written a... wonderful, if I may be so bold as to say, a wonderful, beautifully written, very hot book of erotica,
mm-hmm.
And also wonderful from the point of view of Midrash, for those of you who know what that term is sexual midrash. In other words, midrash is, or why don't you explain to people what midrash is?
It's filling in the lines of what's between the lines in biblical stories.
Exactly.
So not everything is spelled out in the Bible, so I erotically spell out what's going on between the sheets, so to speak.
Yes, and midrash itself is as old as Judaism. That's
right.
what we do.
It's not sexual.
It's usually not sexual.
I guess it gives deeper explanations for all the different stories in the Bible.
Yeah.
So what I'm just doing is doing sexual midrash. It's giving a deeper sexual explanation to stories in the Bible. So you have your couples, you know, Adam and Eve, Adam and Lilith. That's a midrash right there by itself. Abraham and Sarah, David and Bathsheba, Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. So we've got all these different couples.
David and Jonathan and Michal. All of these, right, different groupings. And it's just, I really so enjoy how it is based in a deep love and deep knowledge of the stories in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're into biblical stories and aren't freaked out by the concept of erotica about biblical stories, you will absolutely love this book. Go to lariazilber.com and you can find information on it. Go to Amazon and search for The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible. Don't just search for The Blue Tent and you'll get pictures of blue tents. merchandise. You want a blue tent? We'll sell you a blue tent. No. Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible, and you will get Laurie's book, and you can buy it there. And Judy did the audio.
The audio, right.
And boy, talk about a nice thing to have an audio book for if you're a couple and you'd like to have a wonderful voice of my beautiful wife here.
Yes, you can listen to it together.
You can listen to it together. So we hope you will do that as well. So let us go to our interview with Kathy Slaughter, and we'll see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Kathy Slaughter. Kathy leads Soaring Heart Center in Indianapolis, Indiana, offering talk therapy and coaching. In their off hours, Kathy co-creates spaces where humans blossom at regional Burning Man festivals. Their presentation, Love Lessons from Open Relationships, a 2018 TED Talk, has over 400,000 views. Kathy is a member of a polyamorous family and describes themselves as a late bloomer in the queer world. Kathy, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much, Judy. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. So we always like to ask our guests to start off, how did you get into the work you do? Tell us something about your own journey into this work.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a very different person when I decided to become a therapist, actually. I started my undergraduate experience at Purdue University, a fairly conservative, big university here in Indiana, and originally thought I would be a lawyer. That was like the plan for most of college. And then as I was filling out my applications for law school, I was getting twitchy, very twitchy. And I also had learned about the existence of an MSW. Because a lot of the law schools I was applying to had MSW joint programs with the JD. So you could get both the law degree and the master's in social work. So I talked about that for a hot minute. And then I realized, no, really, my heart is with helping people heal and achieve stability in their lives. Like, I wanted to become a lawyer to help protect people, to help serve families. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the MSW seemed much more closely aligned with my motives than becoming a lawyer. And I also believed that becoming a therapist would help me become the kind of person that I wanted to be, where it felt like, yes, I could be a really good lawyer. I wasn't sure that was going to actually lead me to any personal happiness as a profession. So had some real solid self-interested motives as well in that decision. That's how I got here. I went from Purdue straight to Michigan, got my MSW, and I've been working in the clinical field since 2006.
What do you mean that you're a late bloomer in the queer world?
Okay. Well, like I said, when I decided to become a social worker, I was a very different person. 20 years ago, I was a registered Republican, a practicing Catholic, and I thought I was straight.
Okay.
and now none of that is true. So it took me Took me a long time to really prioritize delving into my sexuality in that way. I think largely because of the Catholic upbringing, also because my early life was very much dominated by a lot of trauma and difficulty that was fairly consuming. So I kind of knew back then, I don't think I fit in these categories quite, but I don't really quite know what to do about it. And it's not quite so painful to really bother with it yet. And I finished school and got married and was doing the whole baby therapist thing. And it just wasn't a priority until we opened our marriage about 10 years ago. And definitely the motive towards opening our marriage was both of us kind of had lingering questions about who we were in terms of intimacy and relationships. And my husband and I knew that when we got together. But that was really where it became like, okay, let's actually look at this. Let's experiment with this. Let's see what's going on here. And before COVID, I definitely knew that I was bisexual. And then as COVID created more space for many of us to confront many things we didn't want to, I started to really hone in on a clear understanding of my gender identity. Because I started identifying as queer in my mid-20s, quietly, mostly to myself, from a very like love of it being an open-ended label. And that's still my preferred label, and I still mean it in a very open-ended, not cis, not straight, do we really have to get into the details kind of way. And our understanding of gender in our field has shifted a lot across that same 10, 15-year span. And so it became important to me to have a more accurate way of discussing my experience. So at this point, I would say I align with being non-binary in a very loose fashion. And yeah, all of
You're
that came.
non-binary, which is I love the paradox. You're loosely non-binary.
Yes.
Don't exactly fit into the not categorical category.
Right.
Sort of fit into the not categorical category, which I just think is really cool. The word queer itself, I'm old enough to remember when that word was used in other contexts, simply meaning different or odd or usual. And it's sort of come around to mean that. Of course, it had its pejorative meaning in the, accusing people of being queer also had that sort of
Definitely.
nasty meaning. But in being reclaimed, it's always fascinating because it's interesting as you describe your own experience. You just don't want to be pushed into a box you don't really fit in. And yet you need a way of describing that.
Right. And it's part of my point of view as a therapist, as a philosopher, because that's my undergraduate degree, is a deep-seated skepticism of the notion of identity as a fixed, continual category. And so while I understand how much labels and narratives matter for those of us who aren't part of the more mainstream experience, because our voices have not been heard before, so it helps to have a platform from which to voice them. I'm still very skeptical of identity as a fixed thing. And so, especially when I speak about who I am using those labels for myself, it makes me a little uncomfortable. And that's part of why my love for using queer remains so strong. And like I said, it became important to give people a little more information about where I see myself, mostly for the purposes of conversation and connection.
So, how do you define a polyamorous relationship? Because I know in your TED talk, you had this chart that like a gazillion things. So, can you talk a little bit about the different levels and like all the different
Absolutely.
stuff?
I'm glad you brought up that chart. It's one of my favorite graphics
I
because
love that chart.
I
Yeah.
know. I look at it like I had to stop it so I could read it.
Yeah, that chart. So the chart shows all of the range of non-monogamy, including cheating, which is very much not a part. of ethical polyamory or any kind of ethical consensual non-monogamy.
Mission, right? If you're calling it ethical, then I guess it's not cheating. Yeah.
Right. And cheating, like the it's not cheating is like one of the like very baseline starting points that our community feels like we have to stress a lot, because it is one of the most fundamental things that makes it ethical. That makes and it's the fact that everyone is consenting, and that there isn't, because to me the real pain of cheating is the betrayal. Like that's really with the wound. And so if everyone's consenting and everyone knows that you're fooling around with other people to some degree or other that you've all agreed to, that betrayal piece just is gone now. So it's not an inherently harmful way of relating, because of that. Absolutely everybody must be on board and must be consenting as like the bedrock start point. So within non-monogamy, the potential practices are legion, as that graphic shows. There's a bajillion ways to go about it. And polyamory happens to be one of them. Happens to be the one that I naturally gravitated towards very quickly, actually.
Listeners that haven't seen the chart, you want to talk about the different levels?
Sure.
What do you mean
Yeah.
by you?
Right.
Yeah.
So at its most basic level, in my life, I sort everything in my head by spectrums. And so the non-monogamy to monogamy spectrum is one way you can think about this in a more simplified thing that will be easier to describe in words. So at one end of the spectrum, we have traditional monogamous married, two people who are exclusive as a pair bond for life, hopefully. At the other end of the spectrum, you have relationship anarchy, which is literally connect with whoever you want, however you want to, and figure it out as you go along. And there's multiple stopping points in between. So like closer to the monogamous pair, we have what most people are mo familiar with, which is swinging. Swingers are typically people who are pretty monogamous pair bonded, and they often view having sex with other people as a recreational activity that they engage in as a couple. It's a very couple-centric way of being open. So swinging is closer to the monogamous end of the spectrum. Polyamory, and like in and around swinging, you have what I would call kind of the cluster of open practices. So like people where it's like, if you're on a business trip, you can hook up with somebody and that's cool, but we're not doing any of that here at home kinds of practices. Or everyone is aware that dad's business trips include having fun. But there's basically, as you move across the spectrum, the amount of restrictions around how you can connect with other people weakens. And polyamory, I think, in most iterations is kind of in the middle-ish. Because even within polyamory, you have like five or six different ways, primary ways that people go about polyamory itself. And so hierarchical polyamory is much closer to the monogamy end of the spectrum than non-hierarchical polyamory is.
The hierarchical would mean you have a primary partner, have other relationships that are also honored, but they're not the primary partner.
Right. And so there's a built-in this relationship will get attended to first. Default operating in hierarchical polyamory or non-hierarchical polyamory strives for a much more egalitarian from each to each as needed way of being in relationship. So it's closer to the relationship anarchy end of the spectrum. And you'll have Venn diagram overlap in these places too. So like a lot of people who are non-hierarchical polyamorous would also say they identify with being a relationship anarchist as well. Some relationship anarchists would agree with that overlap, some wouldn't. A lot of these terms are also very much up for debate, and definition and redefinition, within our community as well. So I
Well,
hope.
live in the same house, or everybody has their own domicile, or how does that work?
All of that depends. Like that's part of what is both liberating and terrifying about polyamory in particular, because to me, like swinging and being open are practices that, yes, they're open, and yet they also allow a lot of that traditional monogamous relationship to stay intact, which is cool. Like, no judgment, just realistically speaking, in my experience, that's what it looks like to me.
If I can expand on that a little, so that tell me if this is right, that the implication there is you have a couple, perhaps they have kids. It looks like, because it is, they are a couple raising their kids and they're responsible for those kids. They may
Right.
have sexual and perhaps more than sexual relationships with other people, emotionally deep relationships as well, but they're still a primary couple raising their kids. So
Right.
it looks monogamous in that way.
Yeah, so like their daily life looks a lot more like a typical monogamous couple. Just, when they go out with the girl, their version of going out with the girls is they go over to their other partner's house for a date night.
Yeah.
Where when you start to get more into polyamory, especially the non-hierarchical style, which is the one I'm the most familiar with because that's the one I practice, the sky is the limit. And anything about how, especially the relationship anarchy end of the spectrum, anything about how a relationship operates is up for debate, based on the particular desires and synergies of the various people who are actually in those relationships. So there's a lot of like generally speakings, and there's also a lot of incredibly individualistic setups, and all of that just kind of depends on where people are at in their lives when they come together. So if you're talking about like I would say one of your more typical things that you see, at least here in the Midwest where I live and practice polyamory, is your married couple who have like teenaged children. And so now they're in their like 40s, they're wondering what else is going on in the world. And so they decide to open their marriage to some degree. Those people already have kids in common. They probably already own their house. So they have a lot of financial entanglement in common. Those types of people often pursue a more hierarchical polyamory. Or even if they don't, in practice, their life is already fairly settled and fairly defined. So they're probably going to continue to live in a separate house from whoever they date, if only because that momentum and that solidity was already there. Where you have like a younger couple in their 20s who's like hearing about this polyamory stuff because it's having its day in the sun again, and they decide to jump into it while they're renting an apartment. They may find that there's another couple of people that they really jive with, and the next time everyone's leases are up, we're going to try and move in together. And anything and everything else like that, very much depending on your own desires as a person. And so in a sense, it's very liberating because you can make so many choices independently from one another, rather than it just being, I am in this exclusive committed relationships, and so now this relationship is who I live with, who I cook with, who I sleep with, who I have children with, who I financially plan for the future with. Like, all of those pieces can now be renegotiated and possibly shared.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that I know, and I people don't come to me, I'm not in a polyamorous relationship. I'm quite, male, cisgendered, heterosexual, monogamous. I'm whatever the whatever you, how do you classify that? It's like,
You
what have I got to
could
say about this? Yeah,
say.
which is, mainstream privileged, right?
No.
But having said all that, I do. Yeah, I'm a couples therapist, so I encounter folks who have opened their marriages or have, do various things. They say, hey, people don't seek me out because I'm a polyamory expert, because I'm not. But what I notice happening often in those phenomena, central to what you're talking about when you talk about consent being crucial, transparency is crucial. You have to be clear about what you're doing. And the fascinating things that arise among the folks I've worked with who have opened up relationships is, Well, often, for example, one of a married couple will say, I want to do this, and the other will feel like, I can't say no or I'm going to lose the person. And so they are agreeing, but they're not really agreeing. Or they are really agreeing, but then the shit hits the fan.
Right.
Often the case. And I was just, fascinated as you're describing the sheer multiplicity of options. And on the one hand, that's liberating. And on the other hand, that must be terrifying. Combination. Yeah, speak to that.
Oh my goodness. So, not I do want to point out that not everyone who decides to engage in non-monogamy is already partnered, especially among younger people. There's kind of a generational split in and around like late 30s, early 40s, not older in late 30s, early 40s, and younger, because of the impact of social media and when people learned about polyamory as an option. Not talking about the younger kids who are figuring this out sooner and diving into non-monogamy the minute they dive into dating at all. They're having a different experience. But going back to like our typical opening couple, most of the time, I would say 99% of the time, someone out of that pair led the charge, said, this is what I want. This is where, like, I need this to be happy. Or at least brought it up and started the conversation. Like, there's always a lead and there's always a follower in this evolution. And sometimes the follower is really incredibly reluctant, and so reluctant, in fact, that I would say it's unethical for that relationship to continue. Just generically, obviously, case by case is different, as we know as therapists. But a lot of times, what happens is the person who's not leading the charge, even if they're interested for themselves, sometimes the person who's leading the charge, feelings happen. And so I've met a lot of people who are in this place where they're like, intellectually, I'm committed to polyamory. I understand the values and principles. I understand what I stand to gain from this lifestyle shift. I'm here for it. I'm committed intellectually. Let's go. And my heart is freaking out and dragging its feet and losing its mind. And what the hell do I do now? Because these two need to actually come back in alignment, and right now they're doing this. And that's the bulk of the people that I work with, that are in the process of opening, where it's like, okay, we're really trying to do this. And oh my goodness, this avalanche of emotions that we did not expect. That's a really, really common experience, I would say. And it's what a lot of polyamorous self-help content is also aimed at helping, which is part of why I'm arguing it's really incredibly common.
Yeah, it's, unless you're really secure in your relationship, it's got to set everything totally off kilter. What if he finds somebody else more attractive and then leaves me, and you get that whole.
Yeah, it definitely. I would say it takes the blinders off in some ways. Lola Phoenix, a columnist in the UK that I work with, they like to say that monogamy can give us an illusion of security. Because realistically, anyone can leave any relationship at any time for any reason.
As I
True.
so often point out to my, cisgendered
Right.
heterosexual monogamous couples, guarantees nothing.
Like, we've made promises. We hope that things will continue. And realistically, it could still fail. However, when you decide to be non-monogamous, you're directly, emphatically saying exclusivity is no longer the basis of this relationship, and that is out the window. And so any of the insecurities or foibles that those promises were papering over now come to the top of mind, top of heart experience, and it is rough. I've noticed a lot of people, because my first specialty was working with people that were childhood trauma survivors of various flavors. So the particular breed that I see, is folks who thought they dealt with their trauma or didn't realize they had all this trauma and felt secure in their relationship, and then they opened, and now all of this childhood trauma fueled insecurity shows up on the scene. And these are often people who are like, oh, can I even do polyamory? Can I even practice this lifestyle? This is so painful to me. And it's when I first got into it 10 years ago, everyone was talking about jealousy, but no one was really talking about insecurity. And if they were talking about insecurity, they weren't talking about it at any depth. And so there were a lot of us running around going, okay, I'm doing all the jealousy things, and it's not remotely touching the depth of the pain I am in. And so part of my work has been to also create containers that can help people who are newer to polyamory learn how to handle their emotions and co-regulate and feel grounded within themselves, because now you've taken this relationship and made it more fragile,
Yeah.
or at least seemingly more fragile.
I think, did I notice in your material you're trained in EMDR? Did I see
I
that?
am, yeah.
I am too, actually. I haven't done it for a while since I've been focusing on couples, but in terms of helping people deal with old trauma, so that at least whatever's going on in the present isn't triggering that old stuff anymore, then they
Right.
deal with the present day stuff. I would imagine that's helpful in the work that you do with folks.
Yes, absolutely. That's very much what I, that's a lot of what I do with people. And also just helping folks really rebuild their idea of what it means to be in a romantic relationship with someone, to identify what pieces are important to them, how they want to be treated, what makes them feel loved. Thinking about those kinds of questions more deeply and more specifically than we're accustomed to also is a really core component of the work I do to help people feel comfortable in this uncomfortable adventure they've chosen.
So, if people are considering a polyamorous relationship, would you recommend that they see somebody like you who's been there, has dealt with tons of couples, so you could point out to them the pitfalls, like, you know
Yeah.
what I'm saying? That they
Yeah,
should
one.
have a therapist, in other words, to go before they jump into it, you can help point out.
Yeah. Anywhere along the way, I'm always welcome to join people. I do think having a therapist in place who, whether they live polyamory themselves or not, I don't think is that critical. Because a lot of the ways that we're trained to work with families and work with couples does overlap. I was actually just telling one of my supervisees yesterday that the relationship between two metamors, so two people who are dating the same person, their relationship to each other is called metamor.
Oh.
So the partner of my partner is my metamor. Metamors often are not otherwise entangled with each
I
other.
gotta tell you, there's a Yiddish word,
Yeah.
which means your in-law. I mean, it's a
Yes.
relationship that doesn't apply exactly in English, because my daughter-in-law's parents are my mechatonim, but there's no word for that in English.
Right.
Sons in-laws, but what are they to me? But in Yiddish, they're my mechatonim. It sounds like metamor. It sounds very similar.
Yeah, well, and that's so interesting because what I was about to say is in-law relationships are the analogy for metamor relationships. So in terms of what you think about clinically or principles to guide that relationship in practice, you can very much think about it in terms of like, well, how would I try and relate to my sister-in-law? Just in this case, it's not my brother in common, it's my husband in common. But functionally, it's really, really similar. So as long as a therapist is well trained in polyamory, I think they can be of incredible benefit, whether they live the life or not. Obviously, someone like me does bring that lived experience to the table as well. And I think people could save themselves a lot of trouble by working with someone like me or someone who's trained in and around the beginning of getting into it. But also, the polyamory community is slightly more intellectual than the average, according to studies. And so it's an interesting community in the sense that people tend to do their homework. So we have a lot of free education offerings in cities all over the country that the poly community does for itself. A lot of people read books before they get into it or as they're getting into it. So there's really always, in my opinion, I think there's always been a very strong teach each other and be prepared and study before you jump that does exist in this community. There are also people who just find themselves in these practices and then go, oh crap, it's not going so well. What do I do now? And those folks are fun to work with too. So.
It's, you're reminding me of remembering, well, it was, I guess this happened a lot in like the late 19th century, but then, in my lifetime in mid 20th century, intentional communities, the concept of intentional communities, where again, tended to be intellectual, tended to be challenging, sort of received wisdom. Well, maybe we don't have to live by these particular principles. What happens if we tweak these? It occurs to me, it also reminds me of non-Euclidean geometries, up in the 19th century around the same time. It's like, what if we change this axiom? What happens then? And if it's sort of like what happens with polyamory, what if we change just this one axiom about the exclusivity bit? What if we toss that out? What geometry do we get then? And you like metamors then. It's really fascinating.
Definitely. I would agree with that. And for me, the advanced promise of this relationship style, in my estimation, is an opportunity to relearn how to do community. Because I think a lot of people who look like me, who come from conservative backgrounds, don't know how to do community very well. We were raised in a world where self-reliance was key, looking like you had everything together was critical. And so knowing how to have close, intimate, supportive bonds outside of our romantic partners or our biological family, it's not something we're super good at. Like, loneliness is currently being declared an epidemic by the Surgeon General. Like, our culture is not so great at community. And I'm not saying this is the solution, but I do think part of the solution is polyamorous people learning how to do these intimate ways of relating outside our general norm. Because there are some skills and there are some practices that we need to rediscover, I think, in order to have strong community again.
And that would apply even to people in monogamous relationships, in intentional
Absolutely.
relationships. I'm reminded of, well, we've seen this with several of our guests, actually. One of them, when we interviewed a rabbi who happens to be a gay man, he was talking about lessons that gay men can teach heterosexual couples. About like how do you talk about monogamy? Because the assumptions aren't tend not to be the same among gay men as they are among cisgendered heterosexual couples. So
Definitely.
how do you talk about that stuff? And I think your TED Talk was, love lessons from open relationships. And I think there was an element of that, at least that's what I'm asking about anyway, an element of that about what can we who are monogamous and want to be monogamous learn from the experience of folks who are doing polyamory.
Yeah, one of the pieces I talk about in that TED Talk, and I also still think is a big piece, is doing the time to take deeper dive, deeper reflection, getting more specific about what you want and about what makes you feel good. Because a lot of us are, let me stop, pause. I believe an unexamined life is not worth living. So.
Philosophy major after all, you want that.
Yeah, so this always applies to me, but I do think people tend to follow an expectation of that their of how their life is going to go and find themselves married sometimes. And the one of the terms for this is the relationship escalator, where you spend some time together, you start dating, you start having sex, you leave a toothbrush at their house, you exchange keys, you propose, you get married, you have kids. Like, there's this very like natural progression that we're all supposed to follow. And I think, to me, the invitation from non-monogamous experience is to say, hey, somewhere along there, could you pause and consider, what you actually want for yourself? because that's the piece that I think really matters. My spouse likes to talk about monogamous people who are polyamorous in spirit and ideology, and they're also polysaturated at one partner.
That's interesting.
So, like, they've thought about it, they've put it together, they know who they are and how they want to be loved, and they've come to the conclusion one is good for me. Like, if we could all get to that place, I think in general, people would have much happier and much more satisfying relationships.
That's interesting. You know, there's that, you know, Helen Fisher's work, The Anthropologist. She's written about this. What she says, sort of studying human cultures very broadly, comparing lots of different cultures, many of which were like isolated from other cultures for, you know, millennia. And what we all have in common, if you lump it all together, what we do as a species is serial monogamy with clandestine adultery. That's what we do, you know. And the serial monogamy part, the culture, all the cultures have evolved that. And there are sanctions if you violate it, and yet lots of people violate it. So there's good reason to violate it, and there's good reason for the sanctions. It's fascinating how that stuff all, you know, all fits together. And so, what was my point in, I'm sure I had a brilliant point in bringing that up, but it was related to what we were just talking about. What we were just talking about.
Well, we were talking about the idea of transparency.
Thank you. Monosaturate. Yes, exactly. What she point and other lots of people pointed this out. Even in cultures that allow polygamy, which is almost always one man, many women, part of the rules, the vast majority of men in those cultures only have one wife. They can only afford one wife, perhaps, or perhaps they're polysaturated. You know, that's, that one's enough. That's funny. That's how I feel. I don't know. I've never had any particular interest in polyamory per se, anyway. But I've always been a sort of a one woman man. That's who, you know, it feels like I'm wired that way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think it's also there are assumptions that people bring to the table too. You know, and I think I probably overlap with the rabbi you were speaking to earlier with this piece of it is I see a lot of pain when I work with monogamous couples around places where people assumed they were on the same page and found out they weren't after harm had happened. So like the example I talk about in my TED talk is this concept of an emotional affair. And you know, I think there's a lot of discussion around how secure you can be in your relationship if your partner has a best friend of the opposite sex. Like, that's a situation that makes a lot of people uneasy, understandably. And like, there is definitely like affairs do happen through intimacy creep, for sure. So I understand people's caution around that, and but when they're in a monogamous relationship. The problem is people very rarely pause and say, we're exclusive now, and this is what I mean by exclusivity. You know, we assume that everyone has this commonly held definition of behaviors that are and aren't allowed. And generally, yes, true, there's a lot that is very commonly believed and agreed on, and there's also not. And I think a lot of times monogamous relationships can deal with some unnecessary turbulence because you stumble across one of these discrepancies in definition.
That's Joe Court. We interviewed Joe Court, who's a gay therapist.
I know Joe.
You know Joe, good.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we interviewed him. And of course, he talks about that very idea that you need to, yeah, he was one of the people we got that sense from. Monogamous heterosexual couples need to talk about what the heck do you mean by monogamy? Because just not that well defined, especially in the era of the internet, it's not that well defined.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, so and for me too, it's also like I have no interest in socially sanctioned what is and isn't allowed definitions in this realm. I have an interest in for the people that are in that relationship, the two of them, the three of them, the five of them, do they understand each other and are they making decisions that are clear and in alignment with their values? Yes, awesome. Like that, in my experience, creates really vibrant, flexible, intimate connections.
Boy, that's a lot of people.
It had me thinking about, am I remembering the name of this right in physics, the three-body problem? It's too damn complicated. Like, there's too many possibilities. Like, you can define those ideas about who wants what, But of course, all of those are fluid anyway. You know, they can change over time. And then you're dealing with massive numbers of pairwise and threewise and however many wise relationships. And so it can get, you know, it can get complicated in a hurry, I imagine.
It does. It does. And that's part of why, like, whenever I meet somebody and I, you know, they find out how my life actually works and they're like, man, I do not have time for that. I'm like, you know what? That's okay. You're right. It is time consuming.
I read an article or something where people were commenting the big issue in polyamory is maintaining your calendar.
Yes.
Yeah, or maybe you said, I don't know who said that, but it's I heard. Yeah.
It's a common quip in our culture. I'm not sure how people handled polyamory before Google Calendar existed. I'm glad I didn't have to.
Now, you also mentioned your involvement with Burning Man. Want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, is there anything in particular you want to hear about?
Well, I don't really know much about Burning Man, so
Okay. Yeah, all right. I've been burning for about 10 years. There's a bit of an overlap with opening my marriage and getting into Burning Man. Those two things did happen rather simultaneously in my life. And let's see, Burning Man in a nutshell. That's a really
all I know is that
oh.
it's a festival. People go into the desert and like lose all their inhibitions and scream at the moon and howl and that's
There's a lot of that, yeah.
And burn the There's a big Burning Man, right, involved.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And part of why Burning Man is hard to ex describe is because what it is so variable. It is very much, well, what do you want it to be? And Burning Man itself, the main event, the original show in Nevada, is an 80,000 person event. Like the venue and the whole city gets put together is like 2 miles across at the diameter. So it's a massive phenomenon. And it's completely put together through the will and the creativity of the people who are participating. So there's no paid venues, there's no paid advert, there's no advertising, there's no main stage, there's no performers. Everything that's happening is happening because some burner decided it needed to happen and made it so. And so it to me, what I love about Burning Man is it's an incredibly potent experiment in community. Again, coming back to that skill set I think we're missing. Because when like Burning Man also has created this whole spin-off of smaller events that are similar to Burning Man in essence, but happen all over the globe at different times of the year in different wildernesses. And so I've been to the main event twice now. I've been to 2 dozen other smaller regional festivals. And at those smaller festivals in particular, the community becomes much more potent. So like bigger events, the art is larger and flashier. There's a lot more dance floors to go experience. At these smaller events, the art is there, the creativity is there, but you have the time to slow down and really be present with one another with different parameters than we usually have. And that's why I love it so much, and have found it so transformative, because you walk into a space where people say, be exactly who you are on steroids, and we will welcome you with open arms. And for a lot of folks like myself who felt like they never really quite fit in, like they were always a weirdo no matter where they went, that is an intoxicating offer. And the process of watching people uncover who is this self that I want to radically express is just a delight to watch and a delight to move through yourself, and also contributed to my evolution. I am definitely who I am now because I started going to burns and had a community that was cool with me wildly experimenting with who I was and how I wanted to dress and express myself and name myself. And so I think it creates a venue for healing, honestly, for a lot of people.
It sounds a lot like Rogerian therapy, you know, like it's just radical acceptance, you know, of
Yes.
yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this. What, tell folks how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, we have an Instagram account at Soaring Heart Indy, INDY, for our location, my hometown, Indianapolis. So you can find us on Instagram, or the best place to look us up is our website, SoaringHeartCenter.com. That is our main communication hub, and our email list will definitely make sure you're aware of everything we're up to and all of the offerings we create. So I would recommend getting on our newsletter is the best way to keep up with us.
We'll put
Great.
that information in the notes for this episode. Thank you so much
Thank
for doing
you.
this.
Thank you so much. It's been a blast.
Welcome back. I learned a lot from Kathy. Certainly had told me things I had no idea about,
So
so.
did I. It's funny. She was they. I should say they. She was they pronouns. They were saying at one point, you need to find a. It doesn't matter if the therapist is living the life, but it's good to find a therapist who really is aware of it. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, I've never heard of metamours,
Yeah, right.
and I learned a new term today. I think
Yeah.
that's a really cool term. It's an interesting term. But so I would not be one of those therapists who's well versed. Although, you
Right.
know, doing an interview like this, I'm better versed than I was before, aren't I?
Yes, we've learned a lot from doing this podcast and have met a lot of wonderful people, and it's nice to have met another one today.
And if you know of folks that you would like us to interview, if you are one of those folks that you'd like us to interview, drop us a line. You can go to our website, which you'll find floating above my head if you happen to be watching the video. Most people are hearing this, not
Yeah,
watching it,
most people
actually.
are listening.
Anyway, it's CTIN7. That's the number 7. CTIN7.com, couples therapy in 7 words. If you go to CTN7.com and drop us a line, you can make all those suggestions. You can give us whatever feedback. Please also take a moment to rate and follow and all those things that you can do to let other folks know about our podcast because we like to spread the word. And I think we've covered what we need to cover.
I think we have.
Very good. So until next time,
Remember, be kind
don't panic.
and have faith.